Well, today, Louis, I'm kind of curious about some of the projects that you've been involved with over the last, 20, 30 years. 40 years.
Almost 46 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Because I think when we first started, Mom started working for the Kelowna Museum. They wanted to put together a school kit, and my son wasn't born yet. He's the oldest. I think he's 46 this year. And so that was 46 years ago when they put together a school kit and they got me to be the teacher in Kelowna.
Wow. So what do you mean by school kit? What was involved
with that? Tsuwapmuk, all about Tsuwapmuk people.
Oh, okay. So cultural stories,
yeah.
Objects.
And they had a bunch of stuff there that I could bring around and show to the kids.
Okay.
And it was quite an experience, all over Kelowna, in the Kelowna School District. Tsuwapmuk teaching in Okanagan Territory.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, they got me to build a village or a pit house in the museum, too.
Right. That was a few years later, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I taught all over in that school district. Actually, they shipped me to Victoria for 3 months, and I was over there doing research on Tsuwapmuk people, and they have so little over there. So
what do you mean when you researched? Where did you go to research?
And they have an archive over there, and I went through the archives, and I really was over there for kind of like a holiday, because they kind of ignored me. They gave me a little desk in a corner there, and all the research I did, I found out a few facts of Tsuwapmuk people over there. I found out that in the pit houses, that the first duplex in Tsuwapmuk territory was built over towards Lillooet. It was a square building, and they had a wall in between. He had a wall in between and two ladders coming out, so it was a duplex.
Oh.
And normally all our pit houses were circular.
Yeah.
But I kind of think it was the influence of their trade with the coastal people that made them build a longhouse style.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is kind of weird. And I came across another one was our people never did really carve like the coast. We spent too much time hunting and gathering that we didn't have time to develop any kind of really trade. But there was a pit house over in Merritt that had a face painted on it,
mm-hmm.
or not painted, carved on it.
Mm-hmm.
And what they figured was, it was a warning to people, because at that time the smallpox epidemic was going around, so they're warning people to stay away from there. That's what they guessed.
Yeah.
But so that must have been, I guess when thousands of people were dying from smallpox, I guess they had, dying is something that, that it's inevitable. But see, that's part of our culture that we don't really know much about, because when people die in our families, they stop talking about them. Once in a while, they'd remember. I think I talk about when the women would get together, they'd start talking about somebody who passed away, and they all started crying. And I think it was part of the healing. But other than that, I've never really heard anything about dying. It's always kind of an enigma for me. Because when I wanted my grandparents, the survivors never talked about them. So it's a real mystery to me, because I don't even know my grandfather, who his relatives were, or it's like a mystery, and my grandmother never talked about her family, really. But I think it has something to do with, they're gone, and they went to the spirit world, and so it was a real difficult question to ask her, so... Death is something that I think our people kind of don't really know how to cope with it. Because I lost my daughter a few months ago, and residues of it keeps coming up, the memory. Because, you know, we're the parents are supposed to go before the children, kind of, you know. And so it was, it's something that grieving, I think, is maybe it was taken away from us. You know, my mother talked about in some of her research, you know, that if you're struggling and, you know, things aren't going right, and so go out in the land and lay down and start beating on the ground, cry if you want, get mad, because, you know, Mother Earth will never tell you it's a bad thing or a good thing or anything. She'll take your punishment and look after you.
So was there any writing that you did afterwards, after all the research that you'd done and all of the new things that you learned about Tsleil-Waututh culture?
After I built a pit house at the museum in Kelowna, it wasn't too long after they come up with an idea to write some books for kids, Lach Lachai, telling the story. And so they did, I think, 4 books. They'd done the pit house, fishing, plants, and I can't remember what the other one was. But anyways, there's a story to the one we did down the fishing. Ursula and Tom Hamilton came down to take pictures and do the story on it. We wanted to try torching salmon, you know, with pitch.
Okay, so what do you mean by torching?
Torching, we tied a bunch of pitch wood on a long stick, mm-hmm, and lit it. Because remember, we didn't have gas lanterns or flashlights back in the day.
Yeah.
So they wanted to take pictures of us torching salmon.
So does this mean you're fishing at night?
Yeah, at nighttime. And we were down there, me and my brother Lloyd were down there, and we were torching salmon. We actually caught 4, I think, that night. I took some pictures of I and Lloyd fishing with a torch. Then after we finished fishing with a torch, we built a fire, and Mum opened up a salmon, filleted it, and put it up against the fire and cooked it.
Mm.
So they had fresh salmon to eat, Ursula and Tom.
Nice.
And while we were eating, then I told them, you know what, it's illegal for us to be fishing. You know, you should have seen them right away, because, you know, they could have got charged along with us.
Oh, my gosh.
And so every little sound they heard, you could see them whiplash time. You know, they turn around and really look around to see if anybody was coming. But, you know, that was quite an experience, though, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Brought back a lot of memories at that time, you know, and it still does yet, because we got caught, I think it was around, I think I was about 9-10 years old when we got caught fishing in the river there. Me and Victor August and my dad and Chuck Williams were sitting in a car drinking beer, and we were down by the riverbank fishing. Along comes the fish warden. He tried to take away our spears, and we wouldn't let him.
Mm.
So he said, I'm going to go get the RCMP. When he left, as soon as he mentioned RCMP, you know, that means trouble.
Yeah.
So we hid away our spears, and Victor walked home, and I jumped on the car with my dad and Chuck. Just as we're getting out the gate, the RCMP met us. They ended up charging my dad and Chuck for fishing. They weren't even. So when they went to court, and they got a lawyer from Vancouver to fight their case, and we told them that they could beat it, you know, because they weren't even fishing, you know, it was me and Victor.
Mm-hmm.
They said, no, they want to fight it for our title and rights. So it's back in the 50s. I think it's probably one of the first cases of trying to fight for our title and rights. And I think I was 9 or 10 years old, so it'd be about around 56, 57. Maybe I was a little older, I can't remember. I think it was around 57.
Yeah, because I think it wasn't until the 50s that Indigenous people were even allowed to hire a lawyer for anything.
Yeah.
Because the Indian Act has prohibited them from hiring a lawyer for fighting for human rights.
But we had a lawyer in Gladstone.
That was about, yeah, I think it was in the 50s that finally somebody fought back.
Yeah, and they fought it, and they ended up getting a $35 fine, if I remember right, both of them.
Hmm.
Back then, it was quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the lawyer cost them.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I was kind of mad at fisheries, DFO.
Yeah.
I used to fish all the time. But what I did was, being young and angry, and so I'd bring my rifle down, and I'd fire off a round every so often to let them know I was down there fishing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because that's how mad I was.
Yeah.
And I don't know what would have happened if they'd have came. But, you know, with that anger and us not allowed to fish, and so...
And this is on reserve, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it was down by the delta there in the Simon River.
Yeah.
I guess there was still that anger I had against DFO for not allowing us to fish. You know, we've been fishing all for thousands of years, and mm-hmm. why would they take away our rights to fish?
Yeah.
And so I guess that's a government people's way, you know, we have rights.
Well, that was their, that was the big thing, is controlling the resources.
Yeah.
Right? That's what they wanted.
Maybe they wanted to get rid of us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of course.
You know?
And also, like, so this is also at the time when, in your memory, I remember you've told me that the reserve was much bigger before.
Well, not much bigger than it is now. And I wrote that story in Many Faces of Mount Ida, the history, the Tsalhaya, and our, why we're living where we are now. And... But yeah, I was just totally angry at DFO. They never bothered me. I've been fishing down there for years. I even caught, used to catch about 200 coho a night. And I think I told the story before of how we didn't have deep freezes, so I got my grandmother to teach me how to smoke salmon. I guess maybe I'm still growing up angry at government for what they're doing to us, you know, because our people talked about it a lot, you know, the government did this to us, the government did that to them. But, you know, they're devout Catholics and they never really talked about the church and what effect it had on us. So these are some of the things that, you know, that are coming out now, especially the Catholic religion, you know, they never really, they converted us and then they ignored us, you know. A lot of our people were devout Catholic mm-hmm. growing up. I was for a while, and when I was a young guy, I wanted my first confirmation, and I guess I cried because I wanted a white shirt like everybody else when they get their first confirmation. That I think that was why I wanted it. I think I was only about 5 or 6 when that happened. Mm. But you know, I guess a lot of that stemmed from the angry growing up when I rebel, I guess you could call me. And my lifestyle was really, as soon as I got old enough, and alcoholism slowly took over, and that's when I started getting it more and more into trouble. I think I spent 10 years in and out of jail. Because at that time, you know, it was seemed like it was every time we got into trouble, well, they locked us up, out of sight, out of mind. Because when I first went to court, I had a jailhouse lawyer that said, plead guilty. He said, yeah, you got no record. He said, you can get probation. So I pled guilty. I ended up getting 15 months.
Oh, my God. So what was it that you did? What did you plead guilty for?
Stealing a car. Mm. And so it was an experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was getting close to institutionalized. And I guess a lot of that anger of everybody and everything. My dad beating up on me when he was drunk. Because I asked my mother, after he passed away, I asked him, how come Dad never liked me? He said, oh, I don't know. She said, but I was one of the reliable ones there to hit and abuse, same with her. So I guess that anger slowly, when I was growing up, I in and out of trouble. And one time I started realizing, you know, hey, why am I getting myself into trouble? Was I doing it on purpose now? Because I think I was getting institutionalized, you know, and I started reading about criminology. I started reading more and more books. I read up on criminology, and all they had was facts and figures in their books. And It was kind of boring for me, so I went to psychology. I read all the books on psychology. And I couldn't find any answers there, so I went to sociology. I figured, well, maybe it's society locking me up. Their fault, you know, it was, whenever you're in trouble, you know, it's always somebody else's fault. Still couldn't find any answers to that, so I went to child psychology. Never could get any answers, and I went to the brain, the last one, to figure out how my brain worked, my cortex and all that. You know, but I think that's what, I think that was the beginning of my rehab, you know, just admitting that there was something wrong that I kept going in and out, because I was starting to like it. I never really wasted my time in there. I tell people, you know, I even learned how to be a head cook in there. I was a head barber, I was a projectionist, you name it. I learned a little bit of carpentry in there, so, and I worked in forestry in there, I worked in firefighting in there, so.
You actually formed a lot of skills and your, like, your purpose and your discovery of yourself and your culture and, like, things that motivate you, so that's kind of interesting.
Well, I look back and that's why I don't talk about it too much, you know. I figure it might encourage other people to go that way.
I don't think you're encouraging them by reflecting on your life. I mean, nobody would choose to have the kind of severe trauma that has been inflicted on Indigenous people. Yeah. But I really appreciate that you're sharing these things with us, because these are important aspects to your story about what motivated you to get involved with so many projects, like all the things from fisheries and highways and farming and all the things. So,
well, like I said, that was my first 10 years of my life before I started getting involved in. I think once I started straightening up a little bit, I started getting more and more involved in the work that I and Mum did at the museum in Kelowna. I think that was a really turnaround for both I and her. Mm. And we started getting more and more involved in the culture. So I think I'm the first cultural teacher in the Valley, you know, 46 years ago.
Yeah.
It'd been a struggle, you know, and took me a while before I started really straightening out. It was a lot of anger, and I guess because when I was in jail, I got into fights all the time, and so they took me before the warden, and they said, "You're a troublemaker." He said, "You got a lot of anger in you." And I said, "Well, if you live my life, you'd be angry too." So he said, "Why don't you try boxing? Get rid of some of your frustrations." So I did. I took it up, and it actually worked. I lost my frustrations, and I actually had three exhibitions in there.
What does that mean, exhibitions?
The outside boxing clubs came in, and they fought with us.
Okay.
So, and actually, I was about 140 pounds when I was in there soaking wet. I was one of the hardest hitters in the boxing club. Mm. So, after bouts with North Vancouver there, the head guy of their boxing club wanted me to join them when I got out. Mm-hmm. He said, "I have a potential amateur boxing or professional." So
wow.
Once I got out, I think it was the farthest thing from my mind.
Yeah.
You're about 17 years old, you know, and just glad to be out, you know. And I keep thinking about, you know, I probably one of the punch drunk guys walking around now.
So in a way that led to like your ability, your willingness to fight fisheries, right?
Yeah, well,
that was not the end of your dealings with fisheries, with DFO. But yet you're pretty instrumental in starting the round table, the Salmon River Round Table. So it's kind of like you had come full circle to work with them instead of fighting them. So how did that all happen?
When I first got on council, you know, I tell people, you know, I didn't know anything. Every time I went to a meeting, you know, I was always the one that was quiet because I didn't know what anybody was talking about. So I used Salmon Arms, my college, to learn. And I joined the environmental committee in town here. And most of the time I just sat there and listened. And then one day, Dorothy Argent was in charge of it, and she said, anybody got any other environmental issues? And all I said was our salmon were getting stuck down the delta. And that opened up the can of worms. We started talking more and more about it because everybody took an interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just about every meeting, that's all we talked about. Then we realized we weren't looking at other environmental concerns, so we had to alternate it, have one for the delta and then one for other environmental concerns. So we've started talking about doing some work down the delta. Then we figured out, well, if we fix that, how about upstream?
Yeah.
Then next thing you know, it went all the way up to Douglas Lake. And we got actually all five bands were working on it. The first time the Okanagans and the Suwapmucks worked together. And I guess Douglas Lake, they're Thompson, I think. They're not really. So that's three different bands working on, because we all had the same concern, you know, with the salmon.
So, but you would have had to work with DFO with that project.
Oh, yeah. But I still reminded them about my little set two with them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can imagine those conversations.
Yeah. But, you know, I think I lost all my anger anyway by then. You know, and I started to figure that's the only way now is to collaborate. And because, you know, we can't fix it ourselves. You know, it takes a lot of people to work on a project like that.
Yeah.
We had the farmers, we had all the ranchers up the valley, we had all the native bands involved, and you name it, every ministry was there, forestry, fisheries, you name it.
It was pretty big.
Yeah.
My dad was involved with that, too.
Is that?
Yeah. And because he actually, I think he did a little contract work for DFO at some point, and that's how he heard about it, and he volunteered. He's one of the guys that worked along the shoreline to, you know, place logs and stuff like that to create more spawning grounds.
Oh, riprap.
Yes, that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I learned. I even worked with, had the handicapped people come out, and I had to find work for them too on the river. That's how I got to know them really good too, you know, there. Because remember, their culture, they were special people to us. So I treated them with utmost respect, and you know, I treated them just like I treat anybody else, you know, and I got along really good with them. Every time they see me, Louie!
Yep, you built a lot of relationships through that project.
Yeah. It was. Well, we found out the farmers, you know, they you can't phone them or text them. You got to talk to them.
Yep.
One-on-one.
Yep.
Convince them that, you know, they're not really losing anything, actually, you know, they're actually contributing, giving back what was taken. Especially Mount Ida had a lot to do with it too, you know, because that's our iconic mountain, and it seems like everybody takes an interest in anything that has to do with Mount Ida, because it is part of the river.
The watershed, yeah.
Yeah, so had a lot of fun doing it, though. You know, all the people that got involved, and I had a little office on the reserve there, and they all came out there, a little A-frame we bought off of, I think it was a gift store down by the corner there, with, what's his name, with his fruit stand, which one here where Fisher's funeral home is now, that was originally a fruit stand.
Oh.
Yeah, and that little A-frame was for sale, so we bought it for $1,000. And the man paid to move it over to the reserve there, and it became our office. Kind of worked out pretty good.
Yeah. So that went on for quite a few years then, hey?
Yeah, about 40 years ago.
But the Watershed Roundtable went on, like it was...
Yeah, it was quite a while ago.
Yeah, okay. But I mean, I think it lasted, all like, must have lasted at least 6 or 7 years.
Oh, it lasted longer than that, because they're still running, but... the bands kind of dropped away from it, too. I think they got starting to get more and more educated. They went more into economic development project like that, kind of kind of disappeared from Ulm. I think Splatsina is still doing some work on it, and they do a little bit of work on the river. They got a fisheries, but...
So let's talk about the farming that was happening. We talked before about how the government said, here's some hand tools. Now we want you to be farmers. But actually, the Nisqually Band had a going concern there with a couple of greenhouses. And let's talk about that project.
You know, me and my mother worked together as a team, and we decided, you know, we got lots of land there. Let's look at growing things. Because we had small gardens, you know, potatoes, carrots, and things like that. But, you know, we had an idea. Oh, let's commercialize it. So we started and got tractors, plows, and it kept getting bigger and bigger. We had two tractors and plows. We even went out and got a planter. We got seeders. We got everything that we needed for farming. I don't even know where we got the money. We put in for a grant or something to pay for it. And actually, we even had a U-pick strawberries right at the corner there.
Oh, really?
That was the only one that was making money. Because, you know, business-wise, I think that was our biggest problem. You know, we didn't know how to sell product, you know, marketing.
Yeah, where did you sell it? Well,
the local people, and we traded some fish sometimes, and but mostly it was a local market. You know, people came out and bought things, and but you know, marketing was one of our biggest problems.
Yeah,
because we ended up getting two greenhouses, and what we used for heat was the old creamery. The city was demolishing it, and they didn't know what to do with it, so they gave it to us. It's a big boiler, and they take 4-foot logs in there to keep a fire going, so it heated up the water to heat up the greenhouses.
Oh, okay.
So that was, we built that. I think it was a couple of years down the road there, we had a lot of product.
Well, what did you grow in the greenhouses?
Mostly seeds, you know, getting everything ready, plants. Then in the winter months, Eddie Blackburn was looking after, and all he grew was tomatoes and cucumbers.
Mm.
Not much money in those. And every year it was tomatoes and cucumbers. I was telling him, you know what, we should be looking at something different. And I think our consultant we had that looked for the money for us, he looked at me and he said, oh, an entrepreneur. I didn't know what it meant, but... But, you know, it wasn't making any money. The only one that was making money was you pick strawberries.
Hmm.
And Lorna was in charge of that.
That's your sister.
Because it's right off the highway there, and people could see it, and they came in and got a lot of strawberries.
Yeah, visibility is everything.
Yeah, we had potatoes, we had cabbage, we had tomatoes, we had just about everything. You name it, we had it. But storage was another thing that we didn't have. So I had an idea of getting a root cellar, and I was going to put it into that hillside, but it's way out of the way, so I thought about it for a couple of weeks, and I came up with an idea of building one above ground. So we got the main poles from up the hill, mostly the material up there, and then we got some plywood, made a wall with a 2-foot space in between, and we got some sawdust from Grinrod, I think it was. We covered the whole thing with sawdust.
Oh.
And it worked pretty good because it was 60 feet long and 20 feet wide. So it worked really good. We built all our storage units inside there, and so it worked out really good. So, but like I said, marketing was we had about 80 acres under cultivation at that time. And
so this was like, what, the 90s?
I think the 90s.
Yeah.
It was quite a while ago anyways. The greenhouses, the old parts of the old greenhouse is still there, and the boiler room is still there. Hard to get rid of that. We can't get that big boiler out of there because it's built right, the thing is, the unit is built right around it.
Oh, you built the greenhouse around the boiler?
Yeah.
That was smart. So yeah. Then what happened? Why is it not still in production?
Well, like I said, marketing. We didn't know how to market. And, you know, farming is one of the least paid jobs around.
Yep, you that's know, for sure.
Everybody struggles with growing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of fell apart. It was one of our things, and we talked about building a village up on the hill there, and we even looked at trail riding. You know, we built a little compound up there. I'm using it now for a little bit of storage, but we're going to put our horses in there and then do some trail rides all over in the hillside there. And, you know, we had all kinds of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Have the village there, a traditional village there, and it was quite the thing, you know. But, you know, we wanted to be independent, but we just weren't ready for it. You know, we didn't have the smarts, I guess, and to continue.
I don't think it's as much that, because you have a lot of skills and a lot of, like, you know, well, the deep connection to the land, I think, is so huge, understanding the land.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just so many hoops to jump through when you have a business. And farming, yeah. like you said, is so tenuous. You rely so heavily on the seasons and the weather yeah. and that it just, yeah, it's hard for everybody. And you need a lot of resources.
At the same time, I got a forestry crew going too, at six-man forestry crew.
Hmm.
Tree spacing, you know, it was all tree spacing. I was reaching out to all over, you know, I'd go talk to all the ministries. I got hooked up with Hydro, BC Hydro, and talking to them, you know, they were looking for other ways of, you know, so they didn't do any brushing and weeding underneath the power lines.
Mm-hmm.
So my idea was to plant a lot of our huckleberries underneath, you know, so it'll take yeah. it over.
Yeah.
And I guess it kind of went nowhere, but in my talking with them, next thing you know, my forestry crew ended up getting contracts to brush and weed under the power lines. And I think they were the first company in interior here, I think. Because Gary formed his own company, G&G Contracting. You know, he broke away from government, you know, government funding, and he got his direct awards. And my idea behind that was that, you know, the direct awards were, they got the work that nobody else wanted. So.
You mean like hard to reach areas?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. But it worked out, though. You know, he kept his company going for about 5 years, ran into a bit of trouble, but at least he tried.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's the thing that you're often doing, is helping get things started, right?
Yeah,
like, you
yeah.
can't, you're just one guy. You can't do it all by yourself.
Yeah,
so.
I burnt myself out that time, because I had three out of fisheries crew, six-man fisheries crew, and then I had six agriculture crew and six forestry crew. I had to find work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I negotiated with forestry, and we ended up getting a unit, 20-man unit crew too. So
for,
I had a
like for
fight the fire.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I had 40 people working.
And this is while you were a counselor?
Yeah.
So they were like band employees. Is that right?
Kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you were pretty focused on economic development.
Yeah, well, that's after the fisheries kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
And but it was still on my agenda, though, because I had the six men. They were doing some work on the river.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a challenge, and I think that's when I started getting burnt out. And I went back the old way, and I started drinking. And I just felt, you know, worn, completely washed out. And talking to Bob Griffiths, you know, he was with Community Futures. I really like talking to him because, hey, you know, I've been into economic development. Told him, Bob, I think I'm a failure. You know, I brought everything up to so far and then I kind of burnt out. What he told me started making sense, you know. He said, Louis, he said, you're not a failure. He said, at least you gave him a taste of what it could be like. Work ethics. A lot of our people down this end, you know, they're always finding work. It's not for the band, but they're not working for the band. They're working somewhere else. So, started slowly straightening out. after a few years of thinking about what Bob said, you know, it made sense to me. You know, we gave the people work ethics, mm-hmm. you know, realizing, you know, they had a taste of what it could be like to be on your own. So I think that important to remember. Mm-hmm. Things like that. So I knocked on all the ministry's doors, environment, forestry, you name it. I banging on the doors. It took a lot of work. The only way I could get some rest was I'd look at the conferences and pick one out where it might help. So just kind of like a holiday, I'd go and go to those conferences. Mm-hmm. And kind of helped at the time, but it was just too much for me because I took on too much responsibility and I didn't know how to delegate, you know, after looking back, you know, I felt responsible because I got it going.
Yeah.
So I think that caused my burnout.
Well, and that makes sense because, like, you're a responsible person. So now I want to talk about highways because you had a lot of dealings with the Ministry of Highways, too.
Yeah, back in the day. That's when I first got on council, too. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, it took me a while to realize because, like I said, you know, asked by people, what is the councilor supposed to do? Oh, he's supposed to go to the meetings, you know, look important. So I go to big fancy hotel, carrying around my little briefcase, looking important. I'm a councilor from Salmon Arm. But, you know, and I started slowly grasping on kind of what we're supposed to be doing. And at that time, you know, we had lots of snow back then. You know, three feet of snow all the time, and after they put the highway through, our roads weren't getting plowed because that IR First Nations road was a Trans-Canada at one time. Hmm. So when they built the new highway, they kind of ignored our road. We'd have about 3 feet of snow on there, and we had quite a few elders living there. You know, my grandmother was one of them. So if anything happened to them, you know, we'd have to get a sleigh or something and haul them down to the corner, you know, for an ambulance because none of the vehicles can go down there. Mm-hmm. So I asked Indian Affairs, that's what they were looking after us. So I went over and asked them about plowing our roads, and they said, no, it's city's responsibility. So I can't remember who the mayor was. Might have been Lund, I think. But anyways, I went into City Hall and asked them why they weren't plowing our roads. It's not our responsibility. It said highways. So I contacted Wesley Black. I remember that. He was the minister then. And they said, no, they kept giving me the runaround.
So who did they say that was responsible?
Indian Affairs.
Oh, my gosh.
And Indian Affairs would say highways. So I kept getting runaround.
City, yeah.
So I said, fine. I talked to my people, and we were going to blockade right over at the corner there, the highway going through our land. Mm-hmm. That got their attention in a hurry. Our chief came and supported me, and we all met at City Hall, the three components, highways, city, and Indian Affairs. Mm-hmm. And me and the chief went there, and we met with them. And they settled it, so it became our responsibility.
So then the band had to be the ones to
plow
the roads. Hmm.
Yeah, so, and it was just here lately, they done a road report on our road. And they found out that number First Nations road still belonged to highways.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because they did a report on it, and they really watered it down. You know, they didn't even mention me about threatening the blockade, I guess. And they said they negotiated with Chief Joey Manuel, and everything is copacetic now, but they didn't transfer the land back to us.
Oh.
In Ottawa. So.
So all that time it was highways' responsibility.
Yeah.
Oh.
But now they want to negotiate with us. They wanted us to sign it over, and I said, bullshit, you guys, back in 72, I think it was, when I argued with them, you guys lied to me, you guys said that we owned it. And Ottawa agreed with us that they have to consult with us now to transfer it back to us. So, anyways, that's my little set to with highways.
Yeah. So the highway now, and of course the new, like the renovated highway, of course runs right through Nisqually Reserve.
Yeah.
What was the process for them to have built that? Did they consult with the band then, or did they just do it?
Yeah, they kind of consulted with us a little bit, but my uncle said he got $50 for his property.
$50.
Yeah.
And when was this? This is the
55, around there, 56, I think, when that highway was built.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, consultation wasn't really thought of then.
No, it was more like just...
We're the government, we can do what we want, I guess, yeah. Attitude.
So they expropriated and then just gave you a pittance for property.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I can be a radical when I want to be.
No, I think the threat of a blockade, like, that was legit. But it's so crazy, though, that they lied like that. And
yeah, well, they never done their research.
Yeah.
They assumed, maybe. Mm-hmm. They thought all the paperwork was done, everything. But a lot of people don't realize that was a Trans-Canada at one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so... I remember that.
You remember.
Yeah.
That makes me think about the borders of the reserve, too. So you remember the borders being further into Salmon Arm.
It was before my time.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure, according to the old people, the Piccadilly Road, mm-hmm. 10th Avenue,
yeah,
was the main highway at one time. And it bypassed the whole reserve. It makes sense, you know, because they didn't want to come on reserve back in the day. So they bypassed the whole reserve.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean the highway went, like, through town and then out, like, Silver Creek? Or along?
No, up behind, up in Glenedon Bench and over Colt Hill.
Oh, okay.
And it went through 10th Avenue, Piccadilly, up to Shoemaker's Corner. Okay. I remember my Uncle Bill saying, oh, the old highway,
yeah,
when we went up there.
Oh, yeah.
He remembers it, the old highway, because it was his brother was a chief then, William Pierre East. Mm-hmm. He was fighting because he lost the... Because every summer, remember, we weren't allowed to go out and hunt and gather anymore, so they kept us pretty well on reserves. And Palmer's Creek was ran through it in between 1st Avenue and 10th. And every summer they'd go and camp there because of the fresh water and the cool breeze in there. And so every summer they'd go there. And I think it was back in the, when the railway was built and the settlers started moving in. And they appropriated land. One of the settlers appropriated the land right there. And he started clearing it. And I think my uncle and them were going to go camp over there that one summer, and they chased him off. He said, it's our land, get off. That's when he got involved in title and rights. In fact, he even went to England to petition the Queen for losing their land. And when they got over there, they told him, well, you're over here for nothing. He said, we gave the responsibility over to the Canadian government. So he went over there for nothing. But he was a World War One vet. He lost his arm. He was at Vimy Ridge, William Pierre East. I finally found a picture of him. It was in the archives in Kamloops. Hmm. I just barely remember him. I remember him with one arm, because when I used to go stay with my grandparents, he was there. And there was, I think I remember one guy in the corner there, and all he did was cough, cough, cough. And he was the one with the mustard gas, I guess, and so I don't even know who it was, because they never talked about him after he passed away. They never talked about William Paris either, you know. So there's a lot of them they never talked about. Yeah, so he came back and nothing really happened. That's when they had that real big meeting on title and rights. So I think that, he was one of the first ones to go in for... Because Mom and them talked about the one over at going along Sunnybrae. They used to camp there overnight, and they went to camp there overnight when they were canoeing to a chase. The guy chased them off their land, too. So, yeah, it happens all the time now. All our harvesting areas are gone, even in... Because it was back in the 60s, 70s, we used to go up to Malakoff, pick lowbush blueberries, and... I think it's around where that industrial park is now, the Yard Creek. And we used to go over there and pick lowbush blueberries. There were lots of them then. That's where my grandmother was picking one time, and my brothers would, you know, black was the big thing back in when they were young bucks. And she was picking away, and then she seen that black beside her there, and she thought it was one of my little brothers picking away there, and then... All of a sudden, she looked over here. It was a bear eating right beside her. She chased it away. But yeah, now it's all gone over there, you know, all the blueberries. There's a few. You can go there and get a few now, but not very many left.
And then there was a tule harvesting area locally here, too, that just, you told me once that you and your mom went
Yeah, we used to, because the only best tules was right down that little swamp now, right at the corner of Shuswap and 10th.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little swamp in there, and one summer we were going to go get some tules, and all of a sudden it was all filled in, and they were starting to build that housing they have down there.
Mm.
So we lost one of our tule picking areas. They're hard to come, even now, it's really hard to find them now. I don't know, I think they require a lot of water, and because I find that on the, trail, the foreshore trail, they got some really good tules over there, and real tall ones and big ones, and a lot of bulrushes, so I got to negotiate with them if I need anything. Oh, man, I found out there are some big ones over there, but yeah, that was our harvest area there for a while.
Yeah.
So it's gone now.
Well, I'm really, this has been really interesting listening to some of the projects that you started, that you got going, and that you worked so hard to make happen. And that's why you've got such a reputation in the area as such a bridge builder, because you know so much about so many different things, and you managed to get people interested in working on these projects. So that's been amazing to learn about that.
Well, it's... What you got to do, you got to do.
That's right.
You know, and I started realizing, you know, creating friendship is more important. I guess that anger, I tell people, you know, I sweat to get rid of my anger. I think I sweat too much, and I don't know how to get mad anymore. So, but creating that friendship along the way is more important to me. You know, I always forget about they gave me a couple of words, but I never really think about it. And but you know, it's a lot of times I go down for coffee mostly at A&W and sit there and talk about culture, talk about the old days, or talk about whatever. Coffee chats would go sometimes 2 hours, 3 hours. You know, just having fun, laughing, and talking, and you know.
Yeah, those relationships are the most important thing.
Well, it's important, but, you know, it's fun. You know, I met so many people. You know, my name gets, I think it gets bandied around, but it creates a lot of work for me, though, sometimes.
Yeah. your job isn't done yet. You've got another 30, 40 years of work to do.
Well, here. I promised my girls. I might chase my music career, too. Libby's been after me, so I was thinking, I'm going to see if I could tape a Christmas song for my girls.
A Christmas song?
Yeah.
What? So how would that work? Because Christmas isn't exactly a Sahuapmec cultural.
Well, I'm going to try to incorporate some Sahuapmec singing to it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, either that or I'll get the little people up Mount Ida to help me.
Okay.
And the coyote.
Yeah, and coyote who goes up there and gets them to make all the toys.
Yeah.
Okay.
history.
Yep. Your life history is fascinating. It shows us how many things go behind the scenes to help fuel these projects that you've done that have been so impactful here.
Yeah.
Cook's Gem. Until next time.
Okay.